Greetings, Zimbabwe, Africa, and the world. Welcome to In Conversation with Trevor, brought to you by Titan Law. I go beyond the headlines and beyond the sensational. Today, I'm in conversation with retired business leader and entrepreneur, Kumbirai Katsande, otherwise known as KK. Enjoy this informative conversation. Kumbirai Katsande, KK, as I want to call you, and I'm going to be calling you KK throughout the conversation. Welcome to In Conversation with Trevor.
Thank you, Trevor.
You are the first person that we are having a conversation with in the studio since COVID, and we've tried to make sure that the space is sanitized. Talk to me about how COVID has affected you, your workspace, your work environment, your routines, and that kind of stuff.
I think to a large degree, it has not been too difficult because I'm out of what I might call executive management now, sitting on boards. It's mainly meetings. So we've just adopted these platforms, you know, Zoom meetings and so on. So I've not been too affected like some who need to be on the call face, meeting staff and so on. So I would say nothing too onerous.
Okay. Yeah. Your life, for me, going through your bio, is hugely inspirational. And when I was looking at your bio, I'm like, this is the life of one man. But there's something that stands out, KK, and that is that you are Mr. Seravita. People don't know that. You actually led the team that created Seravita. There isn't a country I've gone to in the region where people don't talk about Seravita. I know Zimbabweans in the diaspora, every time they come home, when before COVID, they would take Seravita with them or ask families to send Seravita with them. Talk to us, KK, about the inspiration to creating this brand, the team that created this brand with you.
So that's obviously something quite close to me. Seravita, it's an amazing product. So when I came back from Jamaica, I'd been with Nestle in Jamaica, 1992. So I had a boss in Switzerland called Alex Yost. So he said to me, "We need a new product, something that's going to be big. So when you give me your monthly report, which was a one-pager, I want one paragraph to be on new products. What are you doing? Have you failed? Have you succeeded? But we need a new product. Our future is in new products." So, and you know, you can't keep writing that, you know, we are trying. That's clearly
ongoing.
Precisely. That's just not on. So I looked at the market at the time. We had some imported brands coming into the country. And this is work that I did personally with my marketing background to look at to map the market and to look at the opportunities with some very good, competent guys at the factory. Martin Mtambanengwe, for one, he had studied at food science at the local university here. So we went to work to see how we can use the equipment that we have, the capacity that we have, and the eating culture of our people at the time. So a breakfast cereal, when I did the map, it was clear. And I listened also to consumers. What is it they don't like about existing offerings on the market? Because one thing I learned in marketing is that marketing is about looking for the gap. Look for the gap. I think in French they say cherche le créneau. Identify the gap and satisfy it. I think we identify the gap and we said, let's go for it.
Mm.
All effort was behind Cerevita. And of course, you know, with the Nestle World, with research, people in Switzerland, they help you with which ingredient, how to treat it in the factory, and so on. A lot of work had been done at the Nestle factory here. And in the Nestle World, there is what is called the Z line. The Z stands for Zimbabwe. This was to do with the special technology for processing cereals, which was the Z line.
Wow.
That was done before I joined Nestle. And really, 94, 95, we are on the market, and the rest is history, as they say.
What gap did you identify? What was that gap?
The gap was, you know, when people are used to Cerelac, they have a problem to graduate out of Cerelac.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept seeing these 16, 18-year-olds, even university students, still eating Cerelac. So I said, there's a gap here.
Yeah.
These are the wrong people. This is for children. And people come here when they go overseas, they take Cerelac with them.
Mm.
So, and then we had these imported products. You put them in your bowl and you add milk. But they were not as filling clearly as Cerelac.
Mm.
So we wanted, I think, something that was like Cerelac,
mm-hmm.
But also which had a family or adult sense about it.
Mm. Does that mean then that the transition as far as marketing the brand must have been easy because of Cerelac connection, or it was tough? Talk to me about that.
In fact, the marketing was not difficult because you know how people say a business, it's a company which has it's an enterprise which has customers who are looking for a product.
Mm-hmm.
You can extend your brands, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have a product and you're looking for customers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had customers, and all we had to do was to give them a product, just to say to them, listen, you have graduated, and we have an offering for you. When we started and we were formulating, you know, Cerelac has milk in it, when we put milk into the Cerevita, which was what we wanted, it made the product expensive. So when we looked at the alternative offerings on the market, so we said, no, that's not the way to go. What else are other people eating in this space, in this market segment? And we could see people wanted to add milk themselves. So we said, there is our solution. That reduced the cost of the product, and we went in with an existing culture.
What does it must make you feel very proud. I mean, you're retired right now.
Yes.
Walking across the airports, traveling across East, Southern Africa, all over Europe, and seeing Cerevita on the shelves.
Oh, it does. It does. You know, I remember my last days when I was working as a manager at Nestle here. We were getting calls from airport authorities, customs people in the UK, Plymouth, Heathrow. What is this? What do you put in this product? We're taking tons and tons of this product into the UK. And yesterday I was talking to the lady who is running Nestle now. She was telling me even in Australia there are people who are asking for it. You know, in Canada, somebody said they visited a Chinese shop and they found Cerevita there, you know. So, no, it's you're right. I feel quite proud and about that product, and I think my challenge was I always thought I would launch another product after Cerevita. It didn't happen,
right.
But I'm hoping there could be an opportunity to do something.
Still, yes. Talk to me, KK, about your choice of science, food technology, and marketing. Where did that come from? Who inspired you to do that? Was this deliberate? Was this strategic, or you stumbled into it?
It's, well, you know, It was not deliberate. I was actually going to study agriculture, crop science. But as it turned out, when I got to Reading University, and they said to me, "You say you were born in town, you grew up in the city. We think it might not be a bad idea if you spend a year on an English farm."
Wow.
Now, this was September, and you know how it's wet and dreary. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? You want me to spend a year on an English farm in this wet weather? I don't think so. So right there, the registration, I'm saying to these guys, what else have you got? You know? And they say, well, there's food science, there's food technology. And I said, food technology, what does that mean? She said some explanation. I said, yeah, I'll go for that. Said, yeah, 4 years. I said, it's okay. I'll sign up. So that's how I decided.
That's how it happened.
Yes, exactly.
And here you are with I
signed up. I must say I've probably forgotten a lot about food technology. so many years ago.
Yeah.
But that's how it happened.
The one thing that got me cracking as I was reading your bio is that you say comic books were a big thing as you're growing up. And, of course, the Bible. Talk to me about your love for comic books, where it came from. Was it dad? Was it mom? Was it friends? And
it was friends. There was my father was a pastor, and so we used to go to various townships, and we used to visit townships here and in the other cities like Bulawayo and so on. And when he started, by the way, his deputy was Lafu Majaivana's father, Reverend George Chuma. And so when we go into townships, there's a gentleman who had these comic books in Zvareseko. And I just took to these comic books. And what I particularly liked was about comic books is, you know, the villains always lost. I mean, the good guys always, you know, got the better of the day.
Yeah.
Oh, this really lifted my spirit. So I just went into comic books. If I had any change in my pocket, I go and buy comic books. There used to be a shop at Kingston's in town here, by then Second Street, near the Mikkels Hotel.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. In school, weekends, when I would come into town on my way to my grandmother in Barrie, I would stop there in the afternoon Fridays and buy comic books.
Which one was your favorite? Do you recall?
I must say my favorite, at first it was Cowboys.
Uh-huh.
And then as I later grew up going into secondary school, it was more the Avengers, you know. There's a kind of a make-believe, you know, the world that you go into and somehow. So it was the Avengers. The Avengers, that was my favorite.
As with the world that we're in now, with the games, which are almost comic book stuff as far as I'm concerned. Are you into that at all?
No.
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 Okay.
No. I think somewhere I seem to have missed.
Lost it.
No.
Also, the fascinating thing is your identifying with the good guys always winning, which connects you with the Bible.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
You know, my father is a pastor, and I think pastors... I'm going back now to when we grew up in the townships. They played a community role, I think, well beyond preaching, praying for the sick. Because remember, life in the townships was very constrained, and people had all manner of issues with municipal authorities. This was left to the pastors to intervene with the authorities and the communities, it was really very very clear with my father that we are here to do good. That's who we are. We are here to do good with our communities, with our families. That's it. And what is interesting is in the case of my dad, this is a church which he started with others, like I say, Reverend George Chuma and others. It was interesting that it was a small group. Mm-hmm. I think some of them had come out of the Salvation Army, the Assemblies of God, and
what
and
is so the church called?
Christian Marching Church.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So it's really amazing that as part of the family you are sucked into this. And what used to happen is, like, you go to Sunday school first thing on Sundays, and then there was a mid-morning church service.
And you went back adults, again.
You went back. So then you went home for lunch. Then you came back for the afternoon service. So in the afternoon, they had what they called open-air service. So you had to walk around, you know, the streets, the townships, you know.
Evangelizing.
Evangelizing. And somehow, you know, beating the drum tended to fall upon me, you know. So you can imagine, you know, you are 13, 14, 10, you're beating the drum, going around the streets, and your friends are kicking ball and so on.
But you're proud of it.
Precisely, precisely. And I have to say, at the time, it was not a question of me understanding what is going on. It was a matter of my dad is doing it, I'm doing it. You know, he says, it's a good thing. You do it. And what I also find interesting is when we get to a church meeting place, if the others have not come, his view was, well, there's 3-4 of us, let's get started, let's get on with it. And I'm thinking, there's 3 of us. You know, and he says, yeah, let's go. They'll catch us on the way. They'll hear the drum, you know, beating. Yeah. These things make an impression on you.
They do.
Yeah.
And anything from mom, mom's side, as far as your upbringing?
Yeah. My mom was a very quiet person. She studied nursing. And my father, he had a very strong character. And like his colleagues at the time, he was also involved in in the NDP to start with, and then ZAPU, and he was detained. He spent some time in detention, you know, at the time, and so my mother was not like that. she was much more withdrawn, but I have to say that there are things that you pick up because, you know, your mom spends certainly your formative years, your starting years with you. And I think you remember certain things. And I've said to people, one of the things I remember from my mother is about how to wash plates.
Uh-huh.
You know, just cups. Like, how do you know that white cup is clean? So I look at it and I'm thinking, oh, there's no dirt. And she says, no. Fill it with your hand. And you know what? You feel it and you can see, oh, there's dirt. It's not smooth. It should be smooth, you know? Mm-hmm. And how, when we grew up, we were using those metal cups. Mm-hmm. You know, they had the lip.
Yes,
they have the lip.
Yes, yes.
And she would say, look for dirt under the lip.
Wow.
You know? Or when you're washing a fork, and she says, look between. That's where the dirt is. And I'm thinking, well, she had a nursing background. But I found it amazing that it was so easy for her to pass on some of these.
Has this stayed with you?
This has stayed with me. This has stayed with me. And well, what I found amazing is when I came back from college and went to work for the Dairy Board, the first task I was given was the fact that the cultured milk lacto, it was blowing up. We were getting a lot of what they called returns coming back because they were blowing, which meant that there was dirt in the milk.
Really?
So it was, they asked me to look, well, why are we wasting so much money and so on. And it turned out to be a hygiene issue.
Wow.
It was cleaning and the whole cleaning regime around in the factories. The selection of the pipes, are we reaching the right
mommy's
temperature?
Teaching comes
exactly
comes
and that came back and I said, wow, this is what mom used to talk about, hygiene, you know. So
fascinating. I remember, you walk us straight dairy board, as general manager of dairy board, pretty 1983 to 1988.
Yes.
What were the highlights for you? What do you remember about your tenure at dairy board? I must tell you before you answer that, we're talking of thing that for me, dairy board reminds me of how this country used to work, reminds me of the culture that we had. I grew up in Magwegwe, old Magwegwe, which was called Duck City, two rooms. And in the evening, my mom would give us empty bottles of milk and 7.5 cents, and would go and put it out in the street.
Yes.
And would go to bed in the township. Mm. We'd get up in the morning, there'll be two bottles full of milk, one silver and one gold. Silver was for full cream, or gold was for
gold
full cream?
Gold was the full cream. Yes, and, yes. And it was there. Silver was the ordinary.
So I want you to deal with that. But what were your highlights for me? For me, Dairy Board was like an institution that reflected and represented who we were.
Yes, I agree with you. I think for me, Dairy Board was really amazing. It was amazing. Well, to start, when I came back from college, I actually had two jobs at the time. One was, do I go to work for Delta or Dairy Board? I decided on Dairy Board.
Why Dairy Board?
I have a colleague who was working at Delta. And so I gave him a call. We were trading together. And so I asked him to say, listen, these two options, October 10, I'm starting. Yeah. Where do you say? And he said, you know. So I said, okay, I hear you. So I'll go away. I don't know what it's like.
Yeah.
But I have to say, when I got there, I gave him a call and I said, you know what? A toss of the coin, I think, is what was required. Because at the time you had to deal with racism. Mm. I mean, it was right in your face.
Yeah.
It was right in your face. And the fellow I was working for at Dairy Board, and sometimes we don't see that how people in senior positions can motivate these youngsters. Mm. So he brought me and he said to me, listen, there are two people in this company who know what they're doing. Me and you. Can you imagine? I've just come out of college, and this fellow is the assistant general manager. He's calling me. I know what I'm doing, so I'm thinking, wow. Oh, there's something here, you know? And what I also didn't realize at the time is he was getting me so motivated to think that, wow, this fellow thinks I'm like that. And actually, a lot of young people, that's all they need. You know,
motivation.
That motivation.
Affirmation.
That is so critical. That for me was one. The second thing, which I think led from that, was he said to me, "When the factory starts, I want you in there. When the factory finishes, I want you in there." Of course, I thought, "Oh, they start at 6 or 7 o'clock. By 4 or 5 o'clock, we're finished." At the time, milk used to come in the churns. These milk cans. They would be delivered at the factory at 5 in the morning.
Mm. Wow.
And sometimes the factory would be finished at 7 in the evening.
Mm.
So at the time I was living in Glenora, so I had to catch the buses there, 3, 4 in the morning. You know, the war was still on, 79, 80, when I started with Dairy Board. And you go around the copy, you know, it's kind of darkish. You walk all the way and... to the factory, so I think that's the second thing for me. Mm. It's motivating these youngsters, and then secondly, to give them a task.
Mm.
And when people are young, I always say give them a lot of work. Mm. You know, get them to work from 5 o'clock until eight. After a few weeks or months, I say to myself, this fellow is a slave driver. You know, and yet if you ask me. I think this fellow is the one person that I owe a lot to.
Mm.
Because he really empowered me, gave me so much to do that I would say to him, whew, I'm tired. I mean, Saturdays I'm in the factory, Sundays I'm in the factory. And you know, we had The factories we had was Chipinge, Mutare, the one here in Harare, Gweru, and Bulawayo.
Mm-hmm.
And we were making cheese in Chipinge, cheese in Mutare, and also cheese in Bulawayo. The Kadoma factory was just starting.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a lot of this work that is loaded onto you. You know, you have to be in Chipinge, you have to be there, and you're working at night. And I worry that a lot of our youngsters are not loaded. They have so much capacity.
Mm-hmm. So we've lost that a bit.
I think we've lost mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. a bit. So I remember that specifically. And also I was given a lot of room to make decisions when mm-hmm. when I moved mm-hmm. into dairy board. I mean, I had tasks to choose a team of people, the likes of Herbert Nkala, I mean, the current CEO.
I was going to get to that, because I think there's a group of you, KK, you know, that we need to sit down with and make sure that we get this DNA from you before you guys depart. I mean, there's Eddie Cross.
Mm-hmm.
There's Nyampinkidza.
Yes, Mishek.
Mishek Nyampinkidza. There's KK. There's
Anthony
Mandiwanza.
Yes, yes.
What a crop of amazing managers, enterprising people, disciplined people, exemplary people. What is it? I mean, I spoke to Herbert, and Herbert says it must have been the milk. Is that how you see it?
Well, you know, I was running the then new cheese factory in Kadoma when Eddie Cross, newly appointed general manager for Dairy Board, just came and said, "Oh, I want you in head office." You know, so when I got there, Anthony was already working at the Harare factory. And so I became production manager, looking after all the factories. I really had this sense that there are two issues with the business. One was people, mm-hmm. and the other was products. If we're the right people and with the right products, we will win. And basically that's how I approached it. I mean, Herbert's case is unusual. I don't think people choose people like that anymore. I mean, he just walked into my office one morning.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I was too busy or what, you know, in his suit. So I said, "Who are you?" He says, "Oh, I'm Herbert Nkala." So I said, "What can I do for you?"
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Oh, I'm looking for a job." So I said, "What can you do?" So he told me he studied science and so on. So I pulled out from the drawer, gave him a form to fill, and said, "Fill in that form. When can you start?"
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Tomorrow." So I said, "It's okay. Turn up at the factory and so on. If anything goes wrong, we deal with it between you and me." And that's how Herbert
got the job.
Now, like I say, people don't do that anymore, you know.
But there must have been something in you and in him that made that chemistry work.
I quite agree. I think, like I say, he came in, and within a few minutes of chatting, I could tell that he's keen. He wants to do something, and I said, "Well, let's give him an opportunity."
Mm.
And some of the colleagues who were already in the company, like Anthony, who was already working at the factory. And one of the things that we did was we worked out a plan for a group of young people, and we sent them to the UK, West of Scotland Agricultural College, to do diplomas in dairy technology.
Okay.
So that whole crop were trained in milk. And I think what that did was to create a commitment for the product, for understanding milk. And you know, the issue with milk is you have to make quick decisions. If you don't, it goes sour on you. Yeah. And once it goes sour on you, I mean, there are all sorts of problems. It's not just the milk you've lost. It's the cleaning and, you know, the reputation and so on. So I thought it was critical that we get this commitment into our people. And remember, they were replacing white people in these jobs who had not themselves got that training. And I think this is one of the things that I've learned through management, that when you make a change, go to the next level. It's an opportunity to go higher, to go further. It's not just a question of, you know, let's have another cup. That's not good enough. I think it's about, it's an opportunity. Let's go to the next level.
And then your next big job was with Nestle, where you stayed for quite some time. There must be lots of memories from you, the time that you spent with Nestle.
Yes. I think certainly I was more mature with Nestle. I spent a year with Nestle in Switzerland and then 2 years with Nestle in Jamaica to understand the full range of activities within the company. They had a system of international management training, and that's the one that I went into. That's when I also trained in marketing. I think that was really amazing. And getting into a multinational environment like Nestle, a Swiss multinational, and the gentleman we had there, Helmut Maucher, who since passed away in 2018, was really a tough fellow. I think the time that he took charge of Nestle, I think represents a complete change for Nestle as an international food company, as the world's food number one company. And it was such a pleasure to be in at a time when he was really going towards his peak as an international manager, and the exposure that they give you. I spent time with Nestle in Nigeria. I spent time with Nestle in the Philippines, Nestle in Sweden, Nestle UK.
Great exposure.
It's such a great exposure, and there are things that you see generally are the same, things like governance, how things are done. And that, I think, was very much instilled in the company culture, what they call Swiss conservatism at the time. How you at the time you get to Switzerland and your business cards are in gray. You are not expected to be too flashy. This is not what it's about. We trust our products. The quality of our products.
You speak for us.
Precisely, and what we say is what we do. We pay our taxes. We don't break laws. We look for the right people. Like when we do interviews, it's not that we want to look so much at what did you train in and so on. That you can train into a person. You look into a person's eyes and you want to understand, can I trust this person?
Wow. And then you did something bold when you helped Nestle when they faced the pressure from the first family, wanting to force them to buy milk from Kushungo, and you managed to ensure that Nestle remained 100% owned. What was that experience like for you, and what did it teach you?
Yeah, that was an interesting, I think, time in my management career, because certain things, I think, in life tend to be clear, what to do. You kind of feel it. Precisely. You feel it in the gut, especially in situations of crisis or complex situations. I think your gut tells you, that's the thing to do. That's not to say it's easy, but what it's saying is that when you sleep, you'll be okay.
Your conscience is clear.
Your conscience is clear. And I think that's where I put that issue in particular. As you know, I was chairman of the company at the time, but I was now spending so much time on this issue, such that we agreed that perhaps I should go back into management, which was okay, but to some degree it wasn't okay because, these large companies, they move with speed. They do things which are not yet in textbooks. Whether it is marketing, finance, whatever. They really move at a very fast pace. But for me, it was a matter of principle. to say, do we have a contract with this supplier? No, we don't have a contract. So what does the company rule say? Company rule say we must have a contract. Mm. So I said, that's clear. That's what we do. Mm. Let's make sure we tell the president that this is the situation. And he did understand. We got word to him to say, listen, we can't. Because you know what happened at the time was there's a journalist, there's a white farmer who had a journalist friend on the Telegraph in London. Wow. And when they came here, he found that Nestle was buying milk from the First Family. Mm. And so he got it into the newspapers. So the CEO of Nestle is visiting London, and this hits him in the face. Mm. So I'm here, and I as chairman, I get a call which says, listen, pull the plug. Mm. So I said, what do you mean, pull the plug? They said, yeah, you're not buying milk from there. So I said, wait a minute, where does this come from? And they said, no, this thing is in the newspapers. It's becoming a controversy. Mm. So I said, whoa, wait a minute. Let's think this through. Mm. Is this a political decision or is it a business decision? So the colleagues in Switzerland then said, how do you mean? I said, listen, the company has been here since 1959. Those are colonial days. Then we had a settler regime, and we continued to buy milk and process. Mm-hmm. We did not take a political position. Mm-hmm. Nestle in South Africa was buying milk under apartheid conditions. Mm-hmm. So is this political? Let's be careful here. So they came back and they said, oh, we hear you. You've got a point. Mm-hmm. So we crafted a statement which went out from Switzerland, which was very clear. You know, we stay in countries to do business. We believe in the future of countries and so on. Very businesslike. Then we started getting boycotts. Hmm. Nestle products being boycotted in London.
It became political.
South Africa, Australia, it became political. Hmm. So I got a call. 2 days, pull the plug. And these are the reasons. I mean, it was quite clear. Mm. And people were beginning now in those countries, they were making fun of the Nestle Nest and putting, you know, cartoons, etc., which it had got out of hand.
Wow.
Yeah. So I perfectly understood, and I found a way to get a message to the president to say that, listen, this thing is out of hand. Mm. There's no way we can avoid this now. We have to pull the plug. Mm. And the word I got back from the president was, yes, it's okay. Mm. But I hope
there was no pushing back.
No. He said, no, I hope it's only me, it's not others, and so on. But it was the other guys around him.
Aha.
You know, the ministers.
Wow.
Yes. You know, who decided to get angry on behalf of him. Yes. So they're the ones who started getting angry and say, oh, no, it won't happen, oh, this and that, and intimidating, you know, coming to see me at the factory.
Where did you get the courage to stand on principle and to push back on these ministers getting angry on behalf of the president? What informed that courage?
I think that there are probably very various factors. The one is, you know, whilst we were growing at university and so on, we were already involved in nationalist politics at university and so on. And I knew most of the people who then became ministers. I know some people might think a person gets anointed because he's been appointed. It doesn't work like that. These are people that we've worked with, and they make the same errors. And,
they're human.
They're human. So I had that sense with those colleagues. But the other, like I said, was just my gut.
That's
just
true.
Yeah, he just told me, listen, this is nonsense, and I think nonsense must be called out.
Wow.
for what it is. I remember one minister coming to see me at Nestle at night because at the time we had this tanker full of milk at the factory, which we were not going to offload, And they say to me, oh, we must offload the milk and so on. So I said, Minister, it's not going to happen. He said, no. I said, Minister, where do you come in?
Mm-hmm.
There's a client there and there's us. Where do you come in?
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand. You know, this is an arrangement between this milk supplier and us as a processor. Mm-hmm. And you are a minister in government.
Mm-hmm.
We even had some ZANU-PF youths come to the factory,
mm-hmm.
to the offices. To say, you must take the milk, you must, you know. And of course, which was quite unfortunate, this heavy-handedness on issues which were completely out of their sphere.
Mm.
So, yes, you say that. I sense that there are certain things that we do in life without much having to think about it. You know, like to say, oh, let me go and ask my brother, or let me ask my friend, how do I deal with this? And I just did that out of the batting. And in the negotiations and discussions that I then had with the president through the then Minister of Industry, Welshman Ncube, it was very clear that I needed to have a mandate, and Nestle was very good. They gave me the mandate to say, listen, you negotiate on behalf of the company. These are the parameters. And I remember one minister saying to me, you are coming. No. We want the shareholder. And I said, no.
I represent the shareholder.
That's what I'm here for. If I sign, they are beholden to that. Mm. If I make a mistake, tough. But that's what I'm here for. You know, and so that helps when people have that kind of level of confidence in you. It helps, and you know very well that wow, I have to make the right decision.
Mm.
I mean, the police picked me up, friend, and took me to the central charge office here, and they said, we want you to tell us why you are not buying the milk
from Kushungu.
Yes. And they picked me up, and our finance director at the time, Farai Munets, and so we started writing, and of course I sent word to our lawyer at the time, Selby
Watcher.
Yes, and Selby then contacted the Minister of Industry, Welshman, who then went to see the president, and Welshman says, he asked the president, why have you arrested him? And he says, the president says, I hope it's not about my milk. This is not something to arrest someone for. No. So then he said, let me ask Shuri. So he called Shuri, and Shuri said, no, I know nothing about it. So I was released, you know, a few hours. So they said, no.
So clearly somebody somewhere was, like you said, getting angry on behalf of the president.
Yes.
And doing their own stuff.
And doing their own stuff. And so I was released and went to see. By the way, I'd closed the factory and sent all the expatriates home.
Because of this incident?
Yeah, because of this incident. We closed the factory and we were not taking
any. How much of this KK happens in the country where people get angry on behalf of the head of state and he has got no idea sometimes? What do you think?
Well, I would think that this happens quite often. I suspect not just in a setting. I think it's a setting where you have somebody in authority, and then there are people around the person, whether it's at a company, and I think for us in business, these are things we need to worry about. And this is precisely why in business you don't, it's discouraged that you employ people who will get angry on your behalf. And I think a lot of the leaders in business and other entities get lost in this space, not knowing that in fact we are creating problems for ourselves. You know, people say, listen, I want people to work around me who will tell me the truth, even if I fire them in the process. And of course, we all get worried about, no. I'm not here to be fired, you know. I'm here to stay, and to stay, I get angry on behalf of.
That's old school values that should last in perpetuity. ethics, the professionalism, standing on values, standing on principles, rather than being swayed by the individual the person that is in charge at that particular time, and being able to stand for what you believe in.
I think you're right. I think a lot of us we worry about the price that we think we might pay, or the price that we see others
paying
for taking a position on values. I mean, during that time on that crisis, I had one senior government official phoning me and saying, "Who do you think you are? Whose country is this?" And so on. You must buy that milk. And I'm thinking, which country does this fellow live in? You know, I've not broken any law here. And
you,
where does he come
him
in?
Which country he's coming from? And exactly. He's asking you which country this is.
Precisely. And I think this is, for me, it's very important to see. That you should be careful not to adjust to his country, but to stay in your country, because I think the pressure for you to shift
to his country
is very, very strong, and is I think it's very, very heavy. I had some strong lessons, and it strengthens your belief that, you know what, if we just stick to the narrow and straight on
you
these
come
issues,
out right.
We'll come out right. Yeah.
You were faced with a similar situation at Ariston, where their land was going to be taken away for coffee and tea.
Yes.
And again, you stood on principles. Talk to me about that. Ariston, you were managing director there.
Yes,
chief executive.
Yes.
And the fast track land reform was targeting productive coffee and tea plantations.
Yes, yes.
And you stood on principle.
Yes.
To ensure that didn't happen. Speak to me about that.
Yes, you're quite right. And I had... Sanyanga was my chairman at the time, and Robin Powersel was also with us. So, I mean, these are seasoned business people, business leaders. In the case of Robbie, former senior civil servant, very solid. And so it was not difficult, I think, with colleagues like that on the board to take a view. Of course, you're on the front line, in the sense that if there are any stones with are thrown, they come at you. And the board members are at their homes, but as a manager, you are there up front. And of course, that time was just before the elections, and you know how people get all worked up around that time, get very, very excited. Yeah, that was a difficult time, but to the positive side for this company, they had actually given away a lot of land.
I see.
And we're working with the farmers that
surrounding areas.
Precisely. So that I think was a plus when we got to senior officials. They could see that no, this doesn't work. I mean, we had the Kent Estate here. It was a similar situation. The sad part is it takes away a lot of your time. Instead of attending to real productivity issues, staff development issues, markets, and you know how it's been difficult for exports out of this country, especially horticulture from that space. So when you have a lot of those noises, it doesn't help in trying to grow the economy. But yes, I but what I find interesting in cases like that, just like with the issue with the milk situation, you don't have time to think about what's the long term, you know, on me. What you know is I'm doing the right thing, and in the sense that when you do the right thing, you've taken care of the long term.
Wow.
You know,
I love that. I love
because
that.
I think too often you get lost in the is this thing going to take me where and so on, and then you lose it. You lose where you are. You know, so that I think has been a big lesson for me to do the right thing now. You know, just
in
do the right
moment.
Thing in this moment. Just do the right thing, and that will take care. You know, because if you end up to say, no, I want to be in this place and this place, when you turn back to say, what do I do? That might not be the right thing.
Mm. Yeah. I must press you on this, which I've found fascinating about the way you think and the way you've conducted yourself, is you keep referring to the gut feel. How much does the gut feel inform the moment as compared to the analysis and everything else in your leadership style?
I must say that there is a place for the analysis. I think that's very important in the sense that it helps to bring minds together. You have to go through the analysis. You have to do the analysis. But I think finally the analysis might come up with a solution which is not you. You know, you say, yes, that's what needs to be done. But, you know, for us to be who we are, perhaps we might get there soon, but this is how we are going to handle it. So I think finally one has to be comfortable, because I think if one is not comfortable, even the outcome of the analysis, you will not be able
to get it right.
Yeah, I don't think you will move in with enthusiasm. Mm. And if you run into difficulties, I think it won't be too difficult to retreat. Mm. But if I think you're working to your gut, but like I say, with so many other guts, it means you need to do the analysis. Mm. Yeah.
You've played a hugely important role in the running of CZI, and therefore the interaction of industry, commerce with government. And one thing that strikes me is the role that you've played in ensuring that the private sector and the government work together. And I can trace that to your father as a pastor, a pastor's son, and the gut feel and the measured way that you look at things. Talk to me about your experience in getting government and the private sector to work together. What have been the big wins? What have been the frustrations for you?
I think when I became president for CZI, the first time, I think it was 1998.
Mm.
I think I'd been chairing the Food Manufacturers Association, so colleagues were aware of my interest in that space. Mm. For business member organizations. And I also have to say this to colleagues who are running companies. They need to get more and more involved in business member organizations. Mm. I think they need to make it a serious commitment. Sadly, that does not always come through.
Mm.
So, yes, 1998, and immediately I was plunged into a crisis. I say plunged in the sense that I think that is a choice. You kind of choose the battles that you go into. You can ignore them. They will certainly affect you. But I think you take a view to say, I think that needs to be dealt with. Remember, 1998, we had the mass stairways.
Yeah.
And the ZCTU. And we had Morgan Tsvangirai and his colleagues. Gibson Spando was the president then of ZCTU. That was really tense. And so we discussed with colleagues in 1998 again to say, listen, do we leave this as it is? But finally, it comes down to you. You have to do the walking, you know. And so I went to see Morgan. They were in this building just across the road from the Mikkels Hotel. So I went to see Morgan, and I said to Morgan, you know, these strikes are not healthy. Things are going to get out of hand here. the whole country is at a standstill, and there's going to be a punch-up. And of course, Morgan said, we are right. The workers are suffering, and the government wants to tax pensions. They want to do this and that. No, we can't have it. So I'm thinking, wow. But Morgan, I think you hold the key. And he said, no, it's not me. It's the other guys who are intransigent. And I said, yes, to get them to move, you have to move, because they think you are the one who is intransigent. So he said, I'm not. Everybody knows I'm not. You know what the old man is like. He's the one who is, stands in the corner. So I said, no. I don't think it's like that. Why don't? So I had about like 6-7 meetings with Morgan, and then Gibson to say, listen, how do we get people to the table? You are quite right. Your arguments, they make sense. And then from the business side, I had Lakama from MCOS, and then I had Ntlantla Masuku, who was president of ZNCC. Fortunately, he was my junior at school. So that helped a lot to get the chemistry there going. So when I got Morgan and Gibson and the ZCTU Council to commit to dialogue, I then needed to get business as well. So I go in Ntlantla Masuku and Takama, and we agreed. Then we went to see Florence Chitauru. She was the Minister of Labour.
Yes.
And we said, please, we need an audience with the President. Mm. We think we should have a dialogue. But before I went, we went to see the President. I said to Morgan, the president is going to ask us, do you believe in ZCTU? He's not going to ask me about you. He's going to ask about me, about my judgment. Because going there is my judgment.
My judgment, yeah. My integrity.
Exactly. It's not you. So I'm not going to trash my integrity there. What you say, you have to mean it, and your team has to be on board. And he said, no, we are all on board. So I said, excellent.
Wow.
So now we're talking about family with Morgan and so on, I think, which always helps. And then Mike Tower set up a meeting. We saw the president, I think, September 1998. We went in to see him. It was a 20-25-minute meeting.
Mm.
And
National crisis resolved.
Yeah, 20-25 meeting, minute meeting. And the president said, okay, why are you here? And we said, listen, Your Excellency, we think your interest is the same as the CTU. You're after the good welfare of working people. You agree. Surely we can work something from there. And he said, yes, I think you're right. But do you believe in those guys? I said, yes. You're sure? I said, yes. They're coming in good faith? I said, they're coming in good faith. So he said, okay. I mean, what do you want me? What are you proposing? I said, President, give us 2 weeks. Not 2 weeks first. I said, President, set up 6 cabinet ministers from economic ministries, 6 business leaders, 6 from labor. And we form a tripartite a negotiating forum, and we deal with these grievances from labor. In fact, that's when TNF was formed. That is the genesis of TNF. That it was formed in that meeting. And so the president said, fine, we will do it. Anything else? I said, give us 2 weeks. He said, no. When I come back from non-aligned conference next week on Friday, I want to see some progress. I give you 1 week. So I said, okay. And he said, what else? This has to be seen to be coming from you. No, we can't make a statement about this. This is yours. And he said, it's okay. I think George Charamba was the principal private sector. He said, yeah, the statement will be out by 4 o'clock. Mm. And it was out by 4 o'clock. That's what we're going to do. And in fact, virtually the rest is history. Within 1 week, we managed to get the issue resolved. And I've always said, I think this is one of the roles of business, to bring parties together and create a sense of community. And I think business needs to be sensitive to this, to be creating these dialogue platforms and so on. And I think in many ways we've picked up from there in some areas. I must say we've not always continued I think to do it as, in my view, as much as we should, I think as business, we can and should do more. I think business has a special place in the life of a nation. I think this is where innovation comes to life. The economy happens in business. You know, when we talk about the economy, you may have the Minister of Finance talking about the economy, but where is it happening?
In business.
It is happening in business, you know. And I think when business sits back and holds back and that does not play a more active role, I think they are shortchanging themselves and also the nation.
Yeah. Well, another thing that you're passionate about is appointment of women to head the corporate organizations that you're currently chairing. What has informed that for you?
Well, this is something that I think needs to have happened well before now. Because I'm thinking 15, 20 years ago, and probably 10, 12 years ago, there was already a view that the African young lady is really the future face of Africa. And you saw 10, 12 years ago, a lot of adverts, there's young African women on adverts, you see a lot of energy is there. And I would even say the African young woman is really the face of the African youth. There's no question about that. I think it's several things happening at the same time, in the sense that our economic situation, our history of sending kids to school, which means girls have also been going to school. And in fact, I've been seeing bigger proportions of girls, even in higher education, than boys or young men. So I think that pressure is coming anyway.
We've been late on this issue.
Precisely, yeah. We've been late. I think that pressure is coming. And so we are seeing that in these particular situations, I think key players have to be shareholders.
Okay.
Yeah, I think in both cases, key players have to be shareholders.
Right.
And like I say, a lot of preparation which has happened with sending kids to school, and the girl child is up there staking a claim, and the shareholders, it makes business sense to do that, and that is, I think, what has really informed us making those decisions. In the one, we are dealing with consumer goods, in the case of Nestle, and who should better know about consumer goods, about food? It's women. In the other, it's a construction company, and of course we have a young lady there who is I think they're doing a decent job, and but also they know, just like us as black young men at the time getting into the corporate sector, we knew that we had something to prove.
Something to offer.
Precisely. And these young ladies, I'm sure they know that they don't have time to make too many mistakes. You know, people are expecting to say, listen, that they must achieve, So they are really driven, just like we were also driven. So I'm really excited, and I think it's marking a new phase, I think, in our corporate culture here.
Fantastic. Well done for that. And finally, let's talk books. You know, you started with comics and then the Bible. Talk to us about, this is a very popular part of the show, the books that you've read that have made an impact on you. I know that you've fallen in love with A Man of All Seasons.
Yes.
You've read it a number of times. Talk to me about that book and the other two books that you want to share with our viewers at home.
Yes. That book, A Man for All Seasons, which I came across when I was still in secondary school, I was particularly impressed by Sir Thomas More's you know, resolve mm-hmm. on a matter of principle.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as we know, he went under the guillotine, for standing on a matter of principle. And I also found amazing the characters, you know, the Cromwells and Roper and these characters on that side. They were not really, these are the guys who were getting angry on behalf of the king, you know, and they were quite happy. The king wanted this resolved, and the actual method was up to the guys getting angry on behalf of. So I found that quite interesting, this book, and I recommend it to a lot of young people to say, you know, reread that book, and you learn something about life.
And the other book is How Rich Countries Got Rich by Eric Reinert.
Yes, Professor Reinert, I arranged for him to come here 2013. In fact, he was here twice and addressed CZI and the universities here. And it's something that I found more and more as one gets older, appreciating, you know, the fact that what makes a child walk is not because it has 2 feet.
Mm.
A child walks because it sees others walking.
Mm. Right.
You've heard these stories about children who are grown up living with animals.
Mm.
They also walk on
fours.
Yeah. Yes. So I never actually thought about it to say, but you know, you walk. But in fact, if although I have 2 feet, if the people around me were walking on fours, I would have walked on fours. And I think this for me is the basic lesson from Eric Reinert's book, to say, look at how other nations have become just societies. They've become prosperous, you know, societies. How come they look at what they have done? Almost a copy and paste. And I know there are people who say, oh, no, we shouldn't copy, we do our own thing. And I say to a lot of them, well, where is your car? It will have four it will have four wheels.
And this is a book that you've bought and given to quite a number of prominent people. KK?
I have given people just to share. I got so excited about sharing. The first book, I had bought it at Nairobi Airport. And I've since been buying copies. I gave the former president a copy. I've given the current president a copy. I was asking the other day to say, President, where are you with that book? Because I've got another that's coming.
Yeah.
Tendai Biti, when he was Minister of Finance, I gave him a copy. I gave Patrick Namas, I gave Bima a copy. Precisely because I just thought we need to share. How come other nations have prospered?
We are in this sad state of
precisely. There are things that they have had to do, and we need to learn from this. That's really the big lesson. And I keep reading that book, and I've recommended it to a lot of people.
And the last book is Collapse by Jared Diamond.
Yes, Collapse, and there's a section there about the Great Zimbabwe. And what he says is, you know, when we visit the Great Zimbabwe, among other, when there's the Mayan kingdoms, the pyramids, we go there with it's kind of a romantic sense, you know, about, oh, you know, our forefathers, great people. And what he says in there was, it's a ruin. It represents failure. Now I say to myself, but wait a minute. There's something there. In other words, that represents a collapse. So normally we don't go there to learn, you know, to say, how do we avoid collapsing, you know? And how do societies collapse? This happens, and then they collapse, and how do we avoid it? So that's one of the books that I've always thought is really, really amazing. I've taken groups of managers during the economic crisis when I was at Ariston. I took a manager. There is a ruin just outside Nyanga. When you go there and you say to yourself, how did people do this? And what I've said to the people, if you look at the Great Zimbabwe, people stone upon stone, did they use scaffolding? How did they do it? These guys didn't have any engineering training, you know. But here we are with computers, with, and we can't deal with basic issues of feeding ourselves, you know,
feeding
water
potholes.
To potholes, water to the townships. You know, we have so much knowledge about dealing with these issues that when we look at our heritage of these ruins, I think we to a large degree, we should be ashamed of ourselves. That we sit on our brains, we should be doing much more. So those are the three books.
What amazing books are Kumbirai Katsande, as I call you, KK, as everybody else calls you, KK. We could have gone, I could go on the whole day, KK, talking to you. Your life journey is an inspiration. And like your middle name, Chimba, you have sung your way through your life and inspired quite a lot of people. You inspire me.
Thank you
so much for creating the time to be with us on In Conversation with Trevor. Allow me, KK, to turn to our viewers at home on the continent, in the diaspora, who follow this show every week, to thank you for watching these quality conversations. We hope you're inspired today by KK's story. To ensure that you don't miss out on any of these shows, please press on this subscribe button and you get an alert every time we have a new show. So until next time, thank you for watching and cheers to you all.